And welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The day today is April 11th, 2023. This is episode 373. You're listening to Radio Warner. You can subscribe if you haven't already at patreon.com/Radio Warner. Get the show, get the newsletters and other goodies. Anyway, I'm Mark Ames. And I'm in Rochester, New York. I'm on the line with John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. the Warnerd, in Italy now. John, how you doing?
Hey, yeah. I'm in Bari, in Puglia, somewhere along the beginning of the boot heel. I've been sick, badly sick for a month now. They yanked a tooth out, a molar out of my mouth, and had a long root and the usual. And there seems to be a new policy in the UK that, you know, no pain relief for that kind of operation, even when it leaves you with a condition that I became acquainted with called dry socket, which means the blood plug that normally shields the hole in your mouth didn't form, so that it's raw bone down there, and it gets remarkably painful. But I got, you know, my mantra, which is, just take ibuprofen. I swear they'll put that on my tombstone. And I think that weakened me to the point that I was kind of out of it for a month, and I apologize to everybody because the newsletters have been delayed, but I have a couple of them almost ready. If I'm healthy for just a few days, I should be able to finish them, but that hasn't happened.
We've talked about this in the past, but it is very hard to concentrate on anything when you have chronic pain. It's hard to have energy.
Yeah. I mean, not and you get sick again. Yes. You get anything that's going around, and I've got something now that made traveling to southern Italy tons of fun. But I'm trying to get better now, and I hope
I don't know how you do it. I hope you stay there for a while. I hope you guys are able to plant yourselves there for a while and not have to travel.
That is the plan.
Yeah. Yeah, so I took a little family trip. It was my older kid who's a second grader now. He had a spring break, and so we took the family to Toronto, which is only like a 2.5-3 hour drive. Waze took us on some weird wrong way. I was like, no, kids, Sammy was trying to tell me, get on the big highway. I was like, Sammy, you don't understand. You listen to Waze, damn it. You know, when you get older, you'll understand what I'm talking about. And of course, Waze like took us on every small country road. I have no idea what the hell was going on. So it was like a 3 hour drive got turned into a 3 hour drive is doable. 5 hour drive is I wouldn't have done it if I thought it was going to be 5 hours. Yeah. Anyway, so we go there. I saw Amr, great Radio Warner guest, Mohammed Amr in Toronto. He took me out for beers and he very kindly, treated me, which I still feel kind of bad about. But thank you, Amr, if you're listening. And actually we talked about an upcoming episode we're going to hopefully do with him soon. So if anybody goes there with kids, all I can say is definitely take them to the aquarium. It's an amazing aquarium. I've never seen anything like it. Like, they did that really well.
Is that the one across the big ramp? It's over a big concrete ramp from...
Yes. Right near the tower. Near that space needle. Yeah, it's amazing. Like, and when you... Especially when you see it through... kids, it's even more amazing. It's like, you know, most aquariums, they're kind of just hand out standard fare and maybe throw in a seal or a shark. But this was amazing. This is really cool. So anyway, then on our way back, as we're approaching the border, and borders always get me a little nervous, and they should get anybody nervous. And I know I'm not carrying any drugs, but I always feel like I am. Or
I always feel like I am. Like, oh God, what about the 2 kilos that are supposedly welded into the door? Yeah. there are none, but I feel it.
Like, or that you're just guilty of something. It turns out I was. Not of that, but so as we're in line, we're literally like next in line to cross. So this way we're crossing back into America. And Canadian border cops, they're not so bad. They're thorough and stuff, but they didn't serve as like, an SS force for Trump as the border guards did here. So US border guards can be pretty legitimately scary.
Are they still wearing those actual jack boots, actual black boots and black pants?
I wouldn't be surprised, but I only saw them in the booth. But they are wearing these like kind of menacing sort of baseball cap type things. You know, it's like SWAT team baseball caps or something. As we're about to get there, my wife pulls out this folder which has my passport, her passport, and then our kids' birth certificates. And then she kind of looks through my passport again, making sure everything's right. And she's like, huh, that's weird. There's these old Russian visas in Mark's passport. And then she flips through again and she looks at it. She's like, is this your current passport? Do you have your other passport? And then she flips it again and sees that this one expired in 2016.
Wow. And it's full of Russian visas.
Yeah. And it's old. Uh-huh. And I thought, wait a minute. This is the one that we gave to Canada to get in. And somehow they didn't see it. And I didn't have another passport. So what happened is I have my old one, which is invalidated in the back. I had it right next to my new one. And I was showing my kid before we left my old one. I was showing him both of them. And I was so out to lunch, I took the old one. So here we are at the border. I'm with an expired passport. Somehow Canada let me in on an expired passport, but I thought, well, these guys, I'm screwed.
Yeah.
So now I'm like, so what? I was just like, holy shit, this can't be happening. It was absolutely surreal. The kids started freaking out. We had to tell everybody to be quiet and calm.
Yeah.
And then I thought, you know, how do you deal with these, you know, Rottweilers? Like, do you try and roll over and say, hey, look, this crazy thing happened, and be honest with them? But then you realize, well, if you do that, then you basically force them to throw the full book at you, whatever the hell that's. I mean, they would just reject me and my wife, who doesn't drive on freeways. I don't know I don't even know what we would do, to be honest. Mm. And so I just kind of, I thought, okay, I just
bluff it out.
Yeah, bluff it out. And, you know, I've had this little, I don't know, gift or something since I was very young. I'd gotten little scraps with police a lot. It happened in Moscow sometimes too. And when I could be busted, it's like I have this possum thing or something where I go incredibly calm. Mm. And I mean, I don't know if you remember that time when that cop with the AK pulled us over and we had some very, very illegal stuff with us.
Yeah.
And he pulled us out of the car and everything. And I just, I don't know. I've been able to do that.
I remember that you told me, you wait over here, because I do not have the possum thing. I have the shrieking thing.
Yeah. The strange thing is, so he, you know, takes the passports. He asked a few menacing questions. Seemed very skeptical. Looked through everything. And then after about, it was much longer than the Canadian passport. After about, I don't know, 5 minutes almost, he just handed the passports back and said,
God damn.
And I don't know what the hell happened. I don't know. I don't know if I have it.
I can tell you, Mark, they're thinking you're going to leave them to Mr. Big. giving you enough rope.
I mean, I don't know. I was like, this is not the expired passport you are looking for. You know,
I did see your skills. So I
no, but this is weird. You shouldn't. This is not like, you know, where he decides to make the next step, which is to look for drugs on me or whatever the hell. Mm. This is, I gave both going in and out the document. I didn't even know the first time, so I didn't have to fake anything. I had no idea. But the second time I did, like in this massive panic, right when we were up, you know, next. And I all I can think of, like my wife looked through the passport and in the back it says, this is invalidated. You know, there's a new passport. Like it's stamped in big letters.
Well, and, I mean, God knows, maybe they didn't want to argue it out with the Canadians. Like, oh, fuck it. Those guys let him through.
I don't think so. I something else is going on. I don't know. You know,
I got to say, I mean, that deserves a Sunday for the kids because they must have kept their mouths shut.
Yes.
I can imagine a lot of small children going, Daddy, did he let you through? Did he notice anything?
I thought Sammy
anything?
Was going to. But what we did is you give the kids a Nintendo or a game on an iPad, and they're well. If we didn't have those, yeah, it would have been over. Yeah. Sammy especially, he'll say everything. Yeah. But yeah, no, thank God. But then Sammy wound up having a dream last night. He knew it was scary because he told me he had a dream last night that we tried crossing the border and police wouldn't let us. They forced us to stay. Then somehow he got taken away by the police inside Canada, put into a hospital, and then like my wife and I came to the hospital to see him and started laughing at him and then shot him.
Yeah,
I know. I was like, Sammy, wow.
This is like, an Alterno Canada.
Yeah, I know.
He's accessing different dimensions there.
I should say, hey, you know, you should read this article by John about Canada. But anyway.
Wow.
So yeah, that happened.
I can't believe you pulled that off. Man.
I'm thinking that somebody listening to this might know how this works. Like something tells me maybe for some freaking reason. Like I thought they also just put it into a barcode scanner. Every passport goes to a barcode scanner, and that's what they really pay attention to. And why the barcode scanner didn't say, you know, expired going in or going out, I have no idea. But if you ask me, that's probably where the problem lay for whatever reason.
Somebody didn't enter it. Some Gary Brecher type disaffected data entry clerk.
Yes, sabotage. Yeah.
I'm going to destroy the machine.
Fucking weird. Anyway, so that happened.
But I mean, I have to say, there is a lesson here for people like me who are fundamentally afraid and servile. And it's something I've learned very late in life. And I think it's a valid life lesson. And I think it could have helped me have a different youth, as in what is called a youth. Four words, always bluff it out.
Yeah, I wish I could apply this to other situations, to a lot more situations. And I haven't for various reasons. But to this particular kind of situation, since I was a kid, and I was a troublemaker as a kid, I really was. Somehow I was always able to, and I say this now, and so I'm probably jinxing my future self, whatever's left in my life, that I'll probably screw it up the next time, but it has worked in the past. Mm. Pretty weird. Right. Yeah. Always bluff it out. But then there are times when maybe it would pay to be more, cowardly, more afraid, more self-doubting and not bluffing it out. And I'm thinking here of our former partner, Matt Taibbi.
now that is a beautiful segue.
Thank you. That's why I'm a pro in this business. Yeah. No, but really, like, I don't want to dwell too long on this, okay? But we've had people asking us and kind of have to say a couple words about it.
Well, it's a pretty big story, not just
it is.
Because we have a history here, but across the whole news spectrum.
It really is. And it's embarrassing. I mean, the first thing that happened was when Matt testified in Congress at this hearing on, you know, censorship and social media in a now Republican-led but with Democrats committee.
In fact, Jim Jordan-led.
Yes.
That was the really shocking part. Like, Matt, don't you see that even if you're going to go in front of the GOP House, you don't go in front of Jim Jordan's committee.
Yeah. Well, not even just in front of them, but tweeting out thanks, a big thank you to him, and looking forward and just being all chummy with him. But he's clearly throwing in his lot with the right now. And, you know, it makes a certain sense. I just, as we said the last time, I don't see how you aesthetically and otherwise stomach being around these people. As a former righty who was actually a right-wing righty, I didn't run there because I got chased there through a Me Too scandal or something. I was there by choice, and I couldn't stand those people.
No, we've talked about this. I was, you know, born to it, and there was always just a huge culture gap there. I hated them as people, but I seemed to be stuck on their side until I was sufficiently revolted to puke them all up.
And he went there totally unprepared. This is the first time he went unprepared. And I, knowing Matt, I'm not totally surprised.
No.
This wasn't ever his strength, kind of like on your feet public, well, argument and speaking, because, well, for a variety of reasons, but one of them just being this very deep sense of entitlement and just assuming that everybody else sees you as great as you see yourself.
Yeah, actually, it's a good example of what you mentioned about when it's good to be a coward.
Yeah.
Like, if you or I were going in front of a committee like that, even if it was an ostensibly friendly committee, though how he could have assumed that, I don't know.
Yeah.
But even then, I would spend the night ahead of my appearance dreaming up nightmare scenarios.
Oh, yeah.
And to some extent,
or just not sleeping, period.
Yeah. Well, I mean, lying awake.
Yeah, I know
awake,
what you mean.
But, and to some extent, that ruins your life. And I'm sure it will shorten my lifespan. And I'm sure it's done wonderful things for my immune system. But at the same time, we've mentioned before, when I get in some situations where some amateur is preparing an ambush for me, it's like, I did 20 years at Berkeley, okay? And it's not really the 20 years of Berkeley. It's the 20 years of being a coward at Berkeley, because you think about all these things and you've anticipated them.
Yeah. I mean, to make a long story short, for those who watched it, I mean, it was, you know, it's a media story, so it's a big deal story. And Matt laid out the case fairly well to a friendly audience with the Republicans, and then the Democrats went after him. And the worst thing imaginable happened, which is Debbie Wasserman Schultz. The most horrible of the horrible DNC people.
Yeah.
The last person on fucking earth you want to have humiliated you and that filmed, stamped, and put down for the ages.
Yeah.
See, I wouldn't survive that. Like, I don't know how Matt's... That's the other thing, too, I guess, which is I don't know how he mentally survived that. I'm sure he, in some ways, he didn't. I mean, I'm sure he took it out on somebody somewhere. But, boy,
he
was
has
that...
He a family, man.
Yeah.
It must have been a hard time in the Tybee household.
I mean, you know... It was brutal because he came completely unprepared. It was as if he had no idea somebody would go low at him. Like, this is Washington. Yeah. These are the Democrats. This is Debbie Wasserman fucking Schultz.
Yeah.
The worst, sleaziest on earth. You should be absolutely prepared. And they nailed him. You know, they nailed him on hypocrisy. But you could, if you assumed that there was going to be hostile questioning, you could have come up with answers. And he couldn't. It was completely tongue-tied. And then to compound that, I was like, why did he go on MSNBC on the Mehdi Hasan show? Well, it turns out it's because he, I guess, felt so good and confident after that, after getting destroyed by Debbie Wasserman fucking Schultz, of all people, that he tweeted out to Mehdi, hey, I dare you to have me on for a debate. I'm not joking you. That's what happened. He dared Mehdi.
I missed that. I was too sick that day.
Did you see what I just did to Debbie Wasserman Schultz? Huh? Would you like a little of that? Huh?
And he made Mehdi Hasan, who is not a star, look like Muhammad Ali.
I mean,
that was the worst. Even if you'd been a Nevada boxing commissioner, you would have had to say, we're going to check this Tybee's license before he gets into the ring again.
Yeah, that was, That was really painful. And yeah, Mehdi was like, you knew that Mehdi was going to ask tough questions, and Matt just, he was so unprepared. Yeah. It was unbelievable. And
he was like, yeah, he went up against a good club fighter, and he was, yeah, he was so unprepared that he couldn't handle that.
Yeah. I got to say, I don't like it. You know, I've been complaining to this, to you and Yasha, like, well, first of all, I don't want anybody to make Debbie Wasserman Schultz look good.
Yeah.
I don't want a former partner of mine in exile, right, and whatever, doing that either. Because me personally, I think it makes us all look bad. Mm. Like, if he's showing himself up to be such a vain and lightweight, you know, just a vain lightweight, like, I feel like it just makes all of us look bad. I know that a lot of people who really admired Matt's writing or just were in absolute shock.
Because they didn't know that, you know, a lot of that shtick was stolen from you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say and that you. Now.
And yeah. you. And then Hunter Thompson. I know it was.
Yeah.
I mean, it was. I know. And that's the thing. And now I don't know what he's stealing from. But
he needed a rudder. He needed some sort of intellectual navigator. Because he was very good. It was like, in military terms, he was a good tactician, but there was mm-hmm. no sense of a larger strategy there. And so he did some really good things for a mm-hmm. while on the U.S. economy. And then he fell for personal insults and got down in a tactical mess with people who turned out not to be such great friends.
And I think if he were sort of, if there's somebody who is his, you know, rudder or light or whatever, who he's trying to imitate now, I think, and it has been for the last, I don't know, a few years, it would be Greenwald. But I got to say, Greenwald is really good at this.
Yeah.
Greenwald does Greenwaldism really well. Like, you have to admire it.
There is a Greenwaldism. There is an ideology there.
Yes.
I didn't see it for a while. He was... when I came across him, it was about Molly, and obviously he doesn't know anything about Molly, but he doesn't think he needs to because he has this ideology, and it fits all sizes according to him, which it doesn't, none of them do, but at least it yields a certain consistency, and Matt's doesn't have that kind of ideology.
And Glenn is also just very, a really good debater. I mean, very pugnacious. And like, if you're going to be arrogant, if you're going to go on right away and be really arrogant, I mean, this is something that Matt showed in that interview, and he's been doing that lately, which is sort of, you know, you're beneath me. So how dare you even ask this or that or the other? My reporting is right there. I mean, you've got to mix it up. You know, just being arrogant is not going to win you anything. And Mehdi's got British training too. And so they're pretty used to this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And they're also used to taking hits too. And it was so surprising to me how little he dished out.
He couldn't, land a punch on the Russiagate stuff. I mean, that's wide open. Even when you – and I do look through comment threads, as I've mentioned many times. When DNC blue check people get hit with the Russiagate thing, they flinch. They they duck. They try to move away. They try to change the topic. But even then, he couldn't land anything on that.
Oh, it was just – it was a bad day.
And then he met Elon.
You sent me that article. That's just crazy. So, then he was getting mocked massively on social media. He tweeted out something saying, I can't remember what the context was, but everybody was sending it to me and tagging me, where he says something to the effect of, I'm never the type who throws somebody I'm friends with or who I work with under the bus.
Yeah.
So don't, I mean, and then everyone said, Mark Ames. I mean, what the hell are you talking about, you know?
Yeah.
But that's, God, man, that guy's brain works in such weird ways. I'm sure
believes
it.
Basically, he offended Elon, who is very much like a lordling. I mean, he should appear in you know, ermine-lined robes because he's very touchy and he gets offended easily. And when he does, he'll call you a pedophile easily, he did to the guy who didn't approve of his cave rescue scheme. He'll say anything. And Matt said the wrong thing. Like he was there's this one exchange between him and Elon where Matt is trying to be friendly in a way that I remember from, you know, Michael Weiss' world, which is sort of NYC media world, where the real thing is to use people's given names a lot and schmooze up close to them so that they can't hit you. And it's an effective martial art in its way, but it doesn't really work on Elon. So he's trying to, hey, Elon, is this really happening? And Elon says, no, we'll fix it. And then he says, you know, something about my subscribers on Substack employ me, and I have a great thing going there. And then Elon says in this sort of Gary Oldman Dracula voice, you're employed by Substack? And it went downhill fast from there.
Yeah, so I guess what was happening is Elon was kind of trying to pressure Matt and anybody else, I guess, on Substack to consider to, I mean, he was pressuring them by making the links invisible, or you couldn't post the links to your Substack so that people would then migrate over to, I guess, a Substack that he wants to start on Twitter.
The Substack was starting a Substack Notes function.
And Substack starting a Substack Notes, exactly, which is like Twitter, I guess.
Yes.
In a way, right? Yeah. But Matt, when he was getting trashed all over the place on Twitter, he said, I cannot stay on Twitter anymore because this is basically hurting my business and you know, this is like a violation. And if I can't post my links, there's no point in me being here. But privately, he's talking a little bit differently. I mean,
Elon, this is bad optics. I mean, that was the weirdest part. Gag.
Like, yeah, that's how they
how
talk.
How can you talk that way?
Yeah. It's like, this is bad optics. If I were to go over to you, the optics would be bad for both of us.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I the whole thing is really, really depressing all around.
Yeah. Well, it made me feel a little better in a way. Like, I'm small. You know, I'm really small. I mean, I'm much smaller than you or Matt. And I'm not totally reconciled to that because when I was young, I very much wanted to be famous. But I don't much now. And it's kind of nice being small because I'm just not a worthwhile target. like when the Afghan war started, the USAF was complaining, there are no good targets down there. So I'm like the Afghan landscape here, and it really pays off.
Yeah. Man, and if you do get as famous as Matt, don't be stupid. That's all I can say. Just don't be stupid. Like, why would you go into these fights? I don't know. Why would he even be on social media, to be honest? Why not just...
Yeah.
Both of us are not on that much. And when I'm on Twitter, generally, maybe I'll try and post something annoying once a day or so on. But generally, I just use it to promote. I don't go there to find all the people who adore me, which isn't many people anyway. But I don't get, you know, that it's just a strange thing to need constant reinforcement of how adored you are. And Anyways.
It's sad, and I really don't feel good about it because Matt, as I've said, taught me a lot of things about how to write stories in a way that would draw an audience. And he was generally very nice to me, too, when I was in Moscow. And the whole thing is depressing.
Yeah, it is. Like I said, I think he's making us all look bad, but it's probably not true. But I just feel like it is, and it pisses me off that way. No one should allow themselves to get pwned by Debbie Wasserman Schultz and MSNBC. Like boom, boom, you know, voluntarily walking in to an ambush twice in a row. I just don't get that.
I'd say three times because Elon is not great at this either. It's just that. I mean, Godzilla doesn't have to be a ballet dancer. Godzilla can walk pretty clumsily into fights and still win because he's that big, and Elon is like that. But Elon is not a genius at verbal fencing in social media. In fact, he's painfully inept. I mean, I'm going to call it Titter instead of Twitter. It's like,
Yeah. But he's worth $2 billion. Yeah. So in that world where hierarchy and pedigree matter a lot, which is what matters to Matt. I mean, it's funny. Matt was going around saying, like, the real scandal here is not everybody can write to Twitter like the Biden campaign did and say, hey, I don't like these tweets. Can you take them down? And then on the quiet, he's like, hey, Elon, head of Twitter, can you fix my links, you know? Yeah. We got to worry about the optics here. Like, what the fuck?
It's a real Daffy moment. Like, oh, Elon, old buddy, old pal.
I mean, it's bad. It's really bad. Right. So that all happened. I mean, it's, you know, vaguely personal news, you know, former colleague of ours, just sliding down, going with the right. You know, you could see more and more like the advantages of going with the right, especially if you're on a downward spiral, because the right as it's constituted today and as it was constituted even like back in the 80s for sure, they just stick with their side no matter what.
Absolutely.
And if you get humiliated, in some ways your stock even goes up because they all get humiliated because they're all idiots for the most part.
Yeah, but that was true up until the time he spoke against Elon. And if when it divides that way, they are going to go with Elon every single time.
Yes.
And they did. I read many a Twitter thread, and it's like, yeah, we like this little honey badger, Matt, as we imagined him. But now he's made Godzilla mad, and forget it.
Yeah, they are very hierarchical in that way, but they won't they won't judge Matt for, you know, crimes in his gonzo phase or in his exile phase. And they'll openly adore him if what he wants is to be adored and hang out with Ted Cruz and that kind of stuff, which is, if that's what you want, man.
That's the hard part to imagine. You,
I know, like,
wanting to hang out with those people, or they're odd little scrubbed, don't need to shave, homeschooled looks with those ties. How could you want to hang out with those people?
You know, God knows, the liberal MSNBC crowd, horrible people too, in a very familiar way, in a deeply familiar, but that doesn't mean therefore I want to go with their opposite number. Like, you know, I guess this gets back to what you're saying. I mean, it's nice to not have to be, or it is a big upside to not being neither super famous nor ever wanting to be super famous. I always wanted to be cult famous, you know.
Well, sure, you want to be The Fall, not ABBA.
Yeah. And so you don't need these giant audiences. Oh, well, if the NPR MSNBC crowd won't have me, then the Fox News Ted Cruz MAGA crowd will have me. It's a shit menu, you know? Don't opt for either of them.
Yeah, thinking about Matt and Elon, I found myself humming a different tune, like literally. This seems to be how I think these days, by humming old songs. And the song was Jonathan Richman, "Someday We'll Be Dignified and Old." And I think the message of the song was, no, we won't.
Oh, yes. So enough of our yakking about that. Let us, I mean, today we wanted to sort of catch up on other current news, not just news that personally affects us.
There's been a lot. I mean, I feel like I woke up from my sick bed and found all sorts of very interesting stuff going on.
Let's do other stuff before we do Ukraine, because Ukraine, Russia, like the good. Let's start with the good news. I mean, Saudis, what's going on? You know, Saudis announcing the end of the Yemen war. Saudis meeting with Houthis, like, you know, thanks to China, helping bring the Saudis and the Iranians together.
In a way, I think this comes down to Ukraine to some extent, that the DNC crowd has gone all in on Ukraine to such an extent that they're straining every bit of leverage they have with every ally they have to push their involvement in the Ukraine war. And that meant that they were messing with Saudi oil production, and that seems to have annoyed Mohammed bin Salman. And he's gotten tired of it, because you mess with his oil production at the same time that you're making noises about a humanitarian concern with Yemen. It may not amount to much. It never did. But it still annoys him. And eventually, he and his allies start to realize, we've got a lot of leverage here. There are other people that we could talk to. Mm-hmm. And he is very much talking to them now. Because, first of all, the war in Yemen was a lost cause. That was clear. It was a lost cause long ago. I mean, we've covered this in the past, but to make a short version of it, Saudi Arabia went in with several trillion dollars worth of U.S. weapons and with U.S. support crews, ground crews, advisors, satellite images, everything, and got its ass kicked by people who had AKs and RPG-7s and a willingness to die and a knowledge of the local terrain, and that was about all they had.
We should add here, this was in 2015, and the reason that the Obama administration supported it was because the Saudis were so angry at the Iran deal, which, I mean, everybody's kind of dumb here, right? Because the Saudis and the Israelis wanted to kill the Iran deal, and then it turned out they thought, oh, that was actually a bad idea. We shouldn't have had that killed. But they were so angry that Obama, at least this was the Obama administration's version, Ben Rhodes and so on, was, well, in order to get the deal through and to appease the Saudis, we backed them. We thought it was going to be a short war, and we backed them on this.
We thought it was going to be a short war. I mean,
every war.
I guess that's probably been true a few times, but it's really hard to think when. I guess Grenada was a short war for all the good that did anybody. But it doesn't usually work. The very many people on both sides thought that the U.S. Civil War would be short and sweet. And that is a good example of willful blindness and how not just how dangerous, but how incredibly stupid it can be, because there was no reason to think that that would be a short war. If indeed it had been a short war and the North had won on the battlefield quickly, there would probably have been a guerrilla war that would have made the actual civil war look like a marching band demonstration.
It would have been all civilian massacres pretty much, right?
It would have been a continuation of Kansas, Missouri on a gigantic scale. So elites, if we can use that word, tend to think that pretty often, and they're usually wrong. They're not always wrong, but they're usually wrong. And I think most likely because Saudi Arabia had been making a trade like, we'll buy your stupid overpriced gold-plated weapons and in return you protect us, MBS probably felt cheated. Like, you know, I bought your stupid gold-plated weapons. I'm going to keep buying them. But they're not helping me in this war, and you're not jumping in with both feet to help me. How dare you?
Yeah.
So.
Well, and on top of it, during the campaign, so, you know, MBS and the Saudis, MBS in particular, got along, you know, swimmingly with Trump and Trump's family and Pompeo and backed him. And they were all involved in, I mean, you know, it's the other joke about the whole Russiagate thing is, I don't know if you saw this, James Bamford is coming out with a new book, and they published an excerpt in The Nation about how deeply involved Netanyahu and Israeli intelligence, privatized Israeli intelligence, how absolutely up to their frickin' eyeballs they were involved and colluded with Trump to meddle in the elections and to help Trump win.
Yeah.
And, you know, crickets, nothing. No crickets. One wants to hear it.
It yeah. really is amazing. I mean, that is the obvious question that comes to mind with Russiagate, but I've never heard it seriously discussed. Like, surely there were other countries that have a record of caring deeply to the point of intervention about the outcome of U.S. elections. Huh? No, I don't know what you're talking about.
The Mueller report redacts the Israeli parts, and then Bamford, I think, got some of those unredacted. I mean, that's where he got a lot of his, he just started FOIAing everything, you know, and got a lot of his reporting from that. It's shocking. And of course, the UAE and the Saudis, you know, and so when the 2020 campaign was happening, I mean, you had, you know, Bonesaw chopping up Khashoggi, who worked for the Washington Post, and Trump backing him. So in the politics of America, the liberals, the center left, of course, were very anti-Saudi. I mean, I remember even some of them talking about breaking relations, McFaul talking about sanctioning them, that sort of thing. Of course, that didn't last. But during the campaign, Biden said, you know, said he's a terrible guy or whatever, and like, we're not going to have any relations. I mean, he talked tough about how he was going to make MBS pay for that and was not going to be like Trump. And of course, the first thing he did when he got into office was try to go and kiss his feet and tell him, you know, that was just a campaign. But I think the Saudis and that, you know, and Netanyahu and the crowd, they genuinely deeply hate Democrats and center leftists in America. And really, I feel like they're moving it to another level. They really hate them, even though the Democrats generally, I mean, look, it was Obama that backed that fucking war. They do just the same as the Republicans, but they don't give them any, the Democrats give them a little bit of grief, or they hold out the possibility of it.
I think they're very sensitive to certain things. And it reminds me of Miller's Crossing. Like, you know, you wouldn't say Johnny Casper was a sensitive guy, but he doesn't like when you give him the high hat.
Yes.
And Obama is like the embodiment of the high hat.
Yes.
And they didn't like it.
Yep. I think it's quite embarrassing. It's embarrassing to Blinken, to the Biden administration, and to the whole foreign policy elite class that, you know, Biden came in, swung one way, swung the other on Iran, which he wasn't able to do any deal with. He promised that he was going to stitch that Iran deal back together. He promised to get tough on Saudis. Nothing happened either way. And China comes in and brokers a deal, not an Iran nuclear deal, but a peace, which is a good thing between Iran and Saudi Arabia. I mean, I think it's a good thing. It may not be something Washington wants, you know.
No, it's in their terms, it's a very bad thing.
They
were very happy to have wealthy proxies handling the Iran thing, which was basically an assignment like, hey, keep the campfire going, keep it burning while we sleep. That was the plan, really. Just keep Iran simmering, keep things moving. And God knows the Islamic Republic regime is a bunch of assholes and mean hicks, and they're very annoying people. But there's no reason for them to be at eternal war with Saudi Arabia. For one thing, the actual war couldn't happen, as we've said before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they lost to the Houthis. They're as fragile, as I've said before, as a moon base, because they're overpopulated. They don't have enough water in Saudi Arabia for their people. But it was useful to have a rich country and a clever, manipulative intelligence apparatus like Israel working closely with the Saudis, who are not that good at spying, but they do work well together. And they don't even bother to hide it anymore. So it was an effective team. And nobody in the D.C. elite wanted it to stop. I mean, they'll back anybody. They were backing Mujahideen Khalq, you know, the absolute loonies, holdover loonies from a dead movement So they'll back anybody who gives Iran grief. But the worst move that I think MBS did was to reach out to Syria as well as Iran. You don't end the war with Syria, because that's one of those moves that, as you've mentioned, people we know who are part of that elite in D.C. say that what these people can't bear is to lose their power to mess with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start saying, we're going to reach out to Syria, we're going to try to end this demonization, that drives them insane.
Yes.
And that's what the Saudis have done.
Yep. And Erdogan as well. I mean, Erdogan, you know, it might be somewhat more expected of him because he's been angry with the U.S. over Syria for quite some time. But with the Saudis now normalizing relations with Assad in Syria, and Erdogan, I think they're having some summit, Erdogan, Assad, and who else? They're going to have this meeting in, I don't know, with the Russians, and finally put it to rest. So then you have the U.S. is the only country that's still, you know, essentially kind of indirectly a war with Assad. And, you know, I mean, even though the actual force, the boots on the ground force is small, essentially the U.S. through its SDF, you know, proxies controls about a third of Syrian territory still, and including the oil generating the revenues. And what are they going to do? I mean, we all know that this next phase of betraying the Kurds is coming. It's hard to imagine, though, that it just puts the U.S. in a really bad position. Like, here the U.S. is illegally occupying, militarily not invited, illegally occupying a big chunk of a sovereign country. And, you know, that's supposed to be, okay, we didn't necessarily invade Syria in the same way, but there was a lot of illegal stuff that went on backing, you know, these Al-Qaeda groups. But it looks funny, kind of, doesn't it? Like,
it will end badly, and it will end badly for the Syrian Kurds, which really breaks my heart, but it will. And I've asked many times, they must know that. What can they do? And maybe it just comes down to the fact there isn't much they can do.
There isn't much. Because at some point they're going to have to turn on us. And that's very hard for them for obvious reasons. But it's the only way that they're going to save their skins, I would think.
Yep. I would advise them to turn on us sooner rather than later. There aren't a lot of good choices, but trusting the U.S. administration doesn't work out much. And and there are other players now. Saudi Arabia has declared itself free of the old alliance. And China is, I mean, to me, China's passivity has been kind of shocking. Like, there are so many moves that China could make when the U.S., the incumbent power, as it were, is being so incredibly stupid that it's not so much the Thucydides trap going on as like, why don't you hit them in the back of the head? Because they're never looking. They're so dumb. But China has been very, very cautious. But now finally we see a few moves, like they're getting involved in this negotiation between Saudi Arabia and Iran, along with Oman. And they're showing that they can be helpful and that there's somebody as a broker besides the U.S., because the U.S. Starts to look really kind of crazy.
Yes.
Like obsessed with a few issues, unwilling to listen.
Unwilling to listen and completely incapable of seeing through other people's interests and eyes and so on. I mean, it's really, that's also to me really shocking. Like, you know, the U.S. just cannot, that sort of elite class cannot understand why any country wouldn't be on board with the whole sanctions regime against Russia, except for nefarious reasons, like either A, they're autocratic and evil, or B, they're victims of Russian disinformation. But like, if we could just overcome that disinformation, they would surely see the way, rather than like what's in their interest. And this isn't China's interest to have these two, these major energy producers getting along. I mean, it's just in China's interest. And then they also get to extend, they get to show that there's another way of global diplomacy besides the US way, which is really kind of insane, as you said. It really is kind of insane, and it looks pretty bad.
And meanwhile, the U.S., one of its other obsessions is Taiwan at the moment. Mm-hmm. It's weird because I've lived through this. I mean, I've lived a long time, and I'm old enough to remember when Nixon opened up to China and just openly ditched Taiwan, like, you know, see ya. That was 1979, and that has turned in a series of ways. Like, for a long time, Taiwan was kind of sad old news, and China was exciting, happy news, and pandas, and smiling faces, and such. And then, slowly, the old Cold War instincts came back, and China was the big risk. There was the new Sparta or some nonsense like that. But now Taiwan is important again. It's weird when you remember these long intervals where there was no mm-hmm. Taiwan. Who cared about Taiwan around 2000? It was nothing. Yeah, I mean, it was like an historical footnote. Kind of nice, but, you know, humid. And now Taiwan is once again the threatened enclave of freedom that it was in 1957. Yes.
And the tripwire for everything, that if Taiwan falls, it's all over for everything that we stand for. And so we must, to save ourselves, it's all of a sudden everything depends on Taiwan. It's nuts.
We all hear about the fact that Chinese aircraft are flying near Taiwan, which they could hardly avoid doing if they're anywhere near some gigantic cities on the Chinese coast. But at the same time, there's this small bit of news on the BBC. As part of its recalibration of its own forces in Asia, the U.S. will carry out its biggest ever joint naval exercises with the Philippines starting on Tuesday. The U.S. has also secured access to 4 additional Philippine bases in the South China Sea, with 3 of them relatively near Taiwan.
relatively near.
Yeah.
Nice word.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's it has been strange to watch. It seemed unreal for a while, but the U.S. is definitely provoking China, doing everything it can to find a way, to find a soft underbellies here or there.
By the way, that reminds me of something I wanted to mention today. What happened to Xinjiang? I mean, when was...
Yeah, it's a great question. I tried actually looking that up too, because were those the re-education camps, which there, you know, we believe that there were real re-education camps. We think the allegations that were made by Christo-fascist loon Adrian Zenz were over the top. But, you know, there was real repression going on there. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, but I could be wrong, you know, a lot of those camps were closed down. You won't get reporting on that. But no. I mean, put it this way, if they were still housing and, you know, processing hundreds of thousands or more Uyghurs and other Muslims, I mean, we'd be hearing about it, right? So I think it's kind of strange.
Well, would we? I mean, I don't even know, because maybe there's other priorities now.
I don't think so. I think I think they actually transitioned them or something, right? I think they basically said, okay, this period of the re-education is coming to an end and things are calmer now or whatever. Mm. It may be linked to COVID as well. I mean, the fact that we're asking about this, I would have prepared for that question. Right. It's great that you raise it. And so we'll find out, I'm sure, from some people in comments, and we'll maybe even bring it up again next episode. But I think I saw like an editorial in the Washington Post. I saw an editorial somewhere, Washington Post or Wall Street Journal, talking about some activist who wrote about how she got caught up in that camp. I don't know, in, you know, sort of 2018, 2019, and then got out, and she's trying to raise awareness about it. And there was this big article about, you know, how horrible it was, but it didn't seem to be, it's weird. It didn't say they were closed down. I don't think they want to say that, but it didn't talk about them like they were in the present tense.
Mm.
You know, so I think the problem is for that world, they constantly need new atrocities. Like, you need a new detail to the atrocity to add to the portfolio that you've been disseminating out there. I don't think you can keep talking about, like, if you say these camps were there and then they closed, it doesn't sound good.
I'm sure you're right, but I'm wondering if some of it was also the source got used up. I mean, Adrian Zenz was an embarrassment.
Yes.
And he got repeatedly exposed as
But
such.
This article linked to him and said, thanks to the, you know, I can't remember what the superlative adjective was, but, you know, heroic work or whatever, of Adrian Zenz, we know about what happened there. And I thought, oh my God, blast from the past.
Yeah.
So no, I think they all just decided to ignore that.
Wow.
You know, I mean, if you asked any of our listeners or people we know about Adrian Zenz, they don't know that he was an absolute lunatic. But if you asked your average person, they'd probably say you must be disseminating Chinese disinformation.
Chinese disinformation. So many disinformations.
I know.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe I've just come back from Scotland, so I'll do Scottish disinformation. Haggis is good for you.
But we should look at that. It is interesting. I mean, I think that the decision has been made that Taiwan is really saving Taiwan is the new saving Uyghurs. And it also has the benefit of boosting naval budgets and air budgets. It's like,
but you know, there is one thing I'll say. I mean, I think you're right, but there is one thing I'll say. I read the NYT. I force myself to do it, and believe me, it does require some self-discipline. Like, this is the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement.
Yes.
I read the NYT even now.
Yes.
And, you know, but one of the results of that is that I see an average of 3 China bashing stories in the front section of the NYT per day.
Yep.
And they were getting increasingly ridiculous. And there was that sense that we don't have a topic right now. We don't have a big theme for these. And there was one that finally just made me laugh out loud, which was, China fails at soccer.
Oh, yeah.
China had this big pro. What does this remind you of? Any other countries? But anyway, China had this massive soccer program or football program. I don't want to start that war again. and it all came to nothing. And the implication was, it's because China is an authoritarian country.
Yes. Yes.
It tried to force this down people's throats. Not like America.
In a free country like America, we freely become soccer champions in another universe, where there are several universes. But
it was just like they were scraping the bottom of the propaganda barrel. Yeah. And that's a deep barrel.
Well, that's the classic, how do we make our audience feel better about ourselves? Let's find something China failed at, you know, anything. doesn't matter that we
failed. It's a little too close to home.
Like, I know. It's weird in that way. It's sort of like, don't you
China,
know that?
Too many guns?
I know. Yeah, it's pretty strange. Speaking of the Good Friday Agreement, this was kind of funny. There was an article yesterday, on April 10th, by Peter Baker. This is called News Analysis. For Biden, an era when treaties are more likely to be broken than brokered.
Suave, that broken, brokered thing.
Yes. Such breakthroughs are harder to achieve in today's fractious world. Actually, China just did it. Like, the whole point of this piece, I was reading this, like, you've got to be kidding me, is, you know, these days it's just so much harder to put these things together. It's like, no, actually, things have gotten worse in America. We make a deal and then the next guy breaks it. We've been breaking deals. I mean, this goes back with Russia, unilaterally pulling. It's basically a post-Cold War thing where it's a disease of hegemony, where the U.S., you know, unilaterally withdrew from the ABM treaty, which is part of what we're all paying for today. No one will link it, but it was a huge blow. We withdrew from all sorts of important treaties that were put together in the Cold War era that we thought we don't need them anymore. And so, we're not as good at this. And the idea when Blinken and Biden came to power was, okay, our people are back in power. That means diplomacy is going to work again and everything's going to be great. What diplomatic genius breakthrough have they done? I mean, I guess you could say putting together, sort of unifying NATO, which was really Putin's doing, was the closest thing to a diplomatic win. But that wasn't hard backbreaking diplomacy. That was fear. Genuine fear among the European elites, not knowing what the hell to do. And they took advantage of it and they've held it together. So that's the one sort of win. But like the China bringing, our client state, Saudi Arabia, together with Iran. And this is about energy and about sanctions. It's what it's really about. I mean, these are all countries that are unhappy with the financial energy stranglehold that the U.S., EU, Japan and South Korea are able to sort of impose. And they're looking for ways around it. For some independence. And this was a huge, that was diplomacy. And the point of this article is sort of like, well, you can't really do diplomacy. It takes so much time, man. Come on, man.
That's a really good point. And there's something else about that story that, because I read this today and there was, apparently part of my problem was grinding my teeth. And this story did a lot of harm to my teeth. So I've paid for this. This Peter Baker article is full of something you see in the NYT all the time. Nostalgia for the late 20th century. Mm-hmm. I guess their audience is aging, but, I'm aging too. And in fact, I'm downright old. And I don't feel any nostalgia for the Clinton years. But they definitely do. And it extends, it makes them say silly things. Like they're quoting Martin Indyk.
I know.
Who was an ambassador to Israel while the U.S. was busy playing carpet to Netanyahu. And he says in a nostalgic way, there's something about the moment that doesn't make it very ripe. It's harder to get big agreements when you're in this adversarial engagement both with Russia and with China. And then they talk about the revival of great power competition, as in these other countries want to, play too, and that just inevitably aroused great power competition. There was the option of standing back a little. I mm-hmm. think that's what Britain would have done, like with the U.S. in the late 19th century. Like, these people are powerful. Do not antagonize them needlessly. Mm-hmm. Make a deal so they join the cartel and we work in concert to exploit the rest of the world, which happened very cruelly but very effectively in British terms. I mean, the U.S. could have done that with Russia's a different thing. Russia isn't big enough to matter in that way, really. But with China, they could have. And
yes,
they chose not to.
What I find just so strange is we're constantly threatening China. If you do this, there's going to be big consequences. Plus, we're sending, you know, plus we're building up this new military alliance, AUKUS. I mean, everything is threats. There's no, I think it's really important and indicative that there's no sort of like carrots of any kind.
Yeah.
Why would they even collaborate with us? So China has to figure out, you know, how to, what China, I guess, would, I assume they've written us off. Like, okay, America is going through a crazy, and so we got to manage this somehow. But one way of holding the U.S. in check, if possible, is by trying to keep the Europeans from going that way. So I thought, you know, Macron's visit, Macron is, I mean, he's a, you know, he's a joke. I had some back and forth with some French people I know about this, his visit to China. Like, I don't believe a word he says, screw him. But, you know, he went there and said something to the effect of, we must not just act like vassals, particularly with regards to China. If the U.S. wants to be have hostile relations with China, that's for the U.S., but we shouldn't just follow them whatever they want because it's not in our interest. And I think what he's doing is really reflecting what the French business elite is saying. Like, you've got to be, you know, the war is bad enough, but if you're going to have a second war, if that's what the Americans want, this will just be absolutely ruinous. Same with Germany. So yeah. I don't know. I don't know where this thing is going to go, but the U.S.
Well, for an example of what we mean by the U.S. behaving erratically and alienating allies needlessly, there was a release of supposedly secret documents, although secret documents often doesn't mean anything. And supposedly by gamers who were just trying to prove some point in some stupid online argument. Oh, yeah, I got these secret documents and they show. But one of the points was that the South Korean government, which has been one of the most obedient client states of the United States, was resisting U.S. pressure to hand over first-line weapons, advanced weapons, to Ukraine. And their concern is, we don't want to get into the international arms dealing business more than we already are. We don't want to get involved in a war that where we have nothing at stake. But the U.S. has been putting tremendous pressure on South Korea, of all places, to do this. That's not, again, you know, this is my Anglophile, Anglophobe thing. It's like the British would not have done that. They would have found somebody more manageable and more already hostile to the Russians to make that deal with.
Yeah, it's I kind of go back and forth on these leaked documents. Overall, I think they are authentic, more or less. You know, I've seen people both sort of on the right, sort of, I don't know, pro-NATO types or pro-Ukraine types who think it's Russian disinformation. A couple of documents were apparently doctored to be more, I don't know, Russia-friendly. And a lot of pro-Russian accounts are very skeptical. Not all of them, though, but a lot of them are. Like Rebar thinks it's disinformation. And what they point out, I mean, the one thing that makes me feel like something's fishy about this is that the New York Times and the Washington Post are reporting so deeply on it. You know, I remember, like, they wouldn't even report on Hunter Biden's laptop story, because if that was Russian disinformation, then all you're doing is helping Russia.
Yeah.
So all they would need is, you know, a call from Langley or the Pentagon to, you know, somebody up top at the New York Times or Washington Post saying, this will help Russia if you run it. And, you know, our press has pretty openly, shamelessly volunteered to be an appendage of Ukraine's information war. And they think they're doing a good thing by doing that. And not that, you know, I mean, you could support Ukraine, but still do your job as a journalist. And they've decided not to do that.
Yeah, you can support Ukraine without getting murderous about it. I mean, I've seen some things on social media that creep me out a little, like a photo of Daria Dugina with, you know, how it started, and she looks so. And then there's just a piece of burned toast and, you know, how it ended. It's like, that kind of makes me feel funny. And,
yes.
You know, if you make me feel funny, ugh.
Yeah. So it that kind of raised a little bit of a bullshit detector flag that it's being so apparently anyway, you know, more or less thoroughly reported day after day. But, you know, what I'm guessing is that no one called them and told them don't do it for whatever reasons, or maybe told them, but not super emphatically. And that has like Rebar and some others, bullshit detectors up. Others who've really gone through this, you know, with the proverbial fine tooth combs, and no, it looks pretty real. I mean, not a lot of this isn't even about the Ukraine war. And some of the stuff that is on the Ukraine war does not necessarily serve the U.S.-Ukraine cause. Like the estimates of losses, the original estimates, not the ones that were later doctored, showed something more like a 2-to-1 casualty rate. That is, say, 2 Russian casualties for every, you know, Ukrainian casualty.
Even less. I mean, it was like, as I recall, it was like total Russian casualties are 190,000 or something.
Mm-hmm. It's very different from what the U.S. officially says, that Russian casualties are like 200 to 250,000. And this had them at like 43,000 or 41,000. So it's kind of, I mean, it doesn't paint the picture that everybody sort of has in their head, which is Russians are like zombies who have people standing behind them with guns in their backs. I mean, I can't tell you how many people believe this. And they just walk forward into meat grinders in Bakhmut and elsewhere, and they get mowed down. And it keeps happening until, like, the Ukrainians run out of bullets and shells. And I don't think that's what's happening. I'm pretty damn sure that's not happening. I think casualties are high, you know, by recent Russian war standards, quite high. And Ukraine standards. I mean, Ukraine casualties, as I understand, are also really high. But I don't think it's been sort of, I don't know, if you were to believe the UK Ministry of Defense reports, official US, you would assume that casualties are sort of like 10-to-1 Russian to Ukraine. And that doesn't come out here. That gets
The leaked figures, as I was saying, the leaked figures that I recall are total casualties for Russia approaching 200,000, total casualties for Ukraine over 130,000. That seems more reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not good news for anybody, which is what we've been saying all along about this war. It's just a horrible thing for everybody. The invasion was a crime, and there's nothing to celebrate.
No. I think one thing that came through from this was that, there were apparently leaked plans about a big counteroffensive coming, you know, aiming towards the south. You know, that's another thing that raised people's sort of bullshit detectors or alarm bells, was that this dump comes right on the eve of, everybody knows that Ukraine has to have a big offensive soon, and they do. So it's like, okay, this is a sort of a disinformation to muddy the waters thing. It could be, who knows, but it doesn't really make anybody look good, is the thing.
No, in fact, the leak was that, Ukraine is having a lot of problems organizing this offensive, and it can't gather the reserves, the resources, any of it.
Right. Their brigades and stuff, I mean, they're kind of hollowed out, and they're still trying to fill them up. And that doesn't look good. You know, on the other hand, Russia has been, we've been almost joking about this for months now on this show. I mean, I think since the last time we talked, they moved a couple more blocks, you know, in Bakhmut.
Yep.
And it's pretty damn stunning that, granted, it's a large battle, but they have much less offensive juice than they had last summer when they had less offensive juice than in the beginning of the war when they took Mariupol and, you know, were able to move around a bit better. I think the big question for what's coming is, you know, eventually I assume they're going to take most, or if not all, of Bakhmut. I mean, they have most of it now. I think it's about 70% or so. But whatever the hell that means. What are they going to follow it up with?
I mean, exactly. You got Bakhmut. Okay, end of the world now. I mean, Bakhmut wasn't anything big until they decided to make it into the new Verdun, and it isn't.
I mean, I think the big key for what's coming up is just who can withstand better what's coming next. Yeah. So, you know, we know that Russia exhausted whatever forces it had with taking Lysychansk and Severodonetsk while the Ukrainians built up these big new reserves and new forces, and then they were able to cut through these hollowed out and already thin anyway Russian lines, especially in the north and Kharkiv region. Now the question is, have the Russians, I mean, is the reason why they're moved so slow in Bakhmut, in Makivka, and, you know, in these places more in the south, is the reason that they're really not putting everything into anything offensive? And what they're really doing is, I mean, I don't know if you ask me, this would be smart. What they're really doing is preparing for Ukraine's big counteroffensive, which Ukraine has to do. Ukraine has to have a big and successful counteroffensive, because it relies so much on, you know, on outside sponsorship.
It's very much like a U.S. political thing. You got the big donors. You got to keep the big donors happy.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I don't know if the Russians are smarter, if they've learned anything, and that's a big if. They haven't put everything into these offensives. And, you know, they've taken casualties, of course. They're everything I understand, even from like Michael Kaufman and Rob Lee and some of these other analysts who are, you know, very pro-Ukraine, very good as well, but very pro-Ukraine openly and not always right. You know, that the ratios have not worked out well for Ukraine for, I don't know, 2 months now, at least 2 months. It is the casualty ratios have not been in Ukraine's favor at all.
Well, I mean, that's possible, but to me, and I think we've talked about this before, the big, gigantic, but purposely avoided lesson of this war is that the Russian army as a threat is a joke. I mean, they couldn't take Kyiv. And you're supposed to worry about Antwerp? I mean, to that extent, I don't quite understand the Western European panic. That makes me think, I mean, long ago, like 35 years ago, I was in Alex Yanov's class at Berkeley, and I was raised on Cold War legends. And as far as I was concerned, the Soviet, as it was then, army was the second coming of Attila. And Alex Yanov was making these jokes about if the Russian army had to evacuate a three-story building, they wouldn't make it past the second floor. And I thought, well, what are you talking about? That's crazy. Because the last thing anybody knew about them was, you know, they beat the Nazis. But that looks like it was true. Mm-hmm. I mean, and nobody wants to talk about that for some reason, but isn't that the lesson of this war?
It should be. I mean, you know, it's what they are clearly not a threat at is in offensive European operations. Mm. Like in that sense, they are a joke. Yeah, I think that's the lesson here. You know, Ukraine has fought really, there's not to take anything away from Ukraine. They've fought very well. There've been plenty of NATO-trained, US-trained and equipped armies that have fled the battlefield and been cut down. So the Ukrainians are really good, but the Russians don't have any juice. Now, if they were invaded, everything might be completely different if the West were to decide to invade Russia, things could be very different. I mean, remember, well, that, you know, the Nazis made that mistake.
That would come into play in Crimea, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the Nazis made the mistake of looking at the Winter War with Finland and thinking these guys are a joke. And didn't work out well. But I think that should be it. And I don't know. I'm kind of wondering if that is starting to sink in. Perhaps not at the elite level, but when you start looking at the politics, the polling, you know, Finland's prime minister, she's the one that got Finland into NATO. She was just voted out. Germany, I looked at the recent polls there. And in the first few months after the war, the Greens, who are the most hawkish party, their numbers went way up. And the Social Democrats, Scholz's party, the chancellor, their poll numbers went up too. And they've been falling hard, particularly the last like 3, 4, 5 months. The Christian Democrats, who are seen as more pro-business and therefore less anti-Russia, certainly less anti-Russia and less enthusiastically pro-war than the Greens, their numbers have skyrocketed. And that kind of crypto-Nazi party, the AfD, the so-called right-wing populist, they're at like 18% now in the polls. So I don't know. I mean, things might be shifting there to some degree. And part of that might be, look, they've been trying to take like this village outside Donetsk since the beginning, you know, for over a year now. They've been trying to take Bakhmut for nearly a year now. Like, we're supposed to worry out here in Germany? Or wherever, you know,
first we take Bakhmut. We will soon. And then we take Berlin.
Yeah. But then we got to get to Pervomaiskaya, number one and number two down the road, which could take another couple of years. Meanwhile, Biden blows up Nord Stream. You know, like, it's just, they might get scared again if Ukraine's military falters in this counteroffensive. That might scare them, freak them out. But anyway, if you ask me, this war has just is going to go on for quite a while longer. This is one thing I've been saying for a while. We both have, I think. Putin cannot, and judging on all of his past behavior, will not like walk away from this without a deal that he thinks he can sell as a victory. It will not happen. And no one's going to give him that deal. And the West is very deeply invested in this. I mean, Washington especially. Washington is so deeply invested in this must be a total defeat for Russia, well, for Putin personally. So there's that. And then you had this weird thing. So in the Financial Times, there was an article leaked out about how Zelensky, according to some officials, may be willing to talk a deal with Russia in which they would essentially recognize de facto that Russia gets to keep Crimea. And then I don't know about Donbass and the other ones, but and that was sort of like, that would be an opening start in some way. Because that's not what Zelensky has been saying. And it's definitely not where the people who have the guns and the power these days, where they're thinking. And literally, like, I don't know, 2 days ago, then his chief of his National Security Council, Danilov, I think his name is, came out and said, if Zelensky even talked about holding any kind of negotiations for a peace deal, it would be, quote, political suicide. He can't.
There's been political murder on similar grounds, so it doesn't have to be metaphorical.
Yeah. No, he can't and he won't. And I think both sides are just waiting for one side or the other to collapse. And that, if it even happens, ain't going to happen for a long while. And
That also that's very much like the 1918 situation.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of great war parallels here.
Yeah.
And on that happy note, I think I have a lot to say about Scotland and about Scottish history, but I think we should do that on another show, because it will take a bit of time.
One thing, I'm sorry to do this. One last thing I forgot to put in here, I wanted to just mention. It's kind of a crazy article, and this will just take 2 minutes. There was an article in the Times UK by Maxim Tucker about, so I'd heard this through some Russian account, pro-Russian account, some version of this, and it was completely mocked and dismissed by all the pro-NATO, pro-Ukraine accounts. In sort of mid-late October, Ukraine launched one of those amphibious special forces assaults on the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, this huge nuclear power plant that everyone is supposedly in the West is hugely worrying about, because if something were to happen there, it could be, you know, really catastrophic, like Chernobyl times whatever number. They're coming out now and saying, yeah, they did try and launch this amphibious assault across, you know, across water using speedboats and using HIMARS missiles. They fired HIMARS missiles
at a nuclear plant.
At a nuclear plant with Americans running the targeting. I saw some people saying, reading this, pro-Ukraine, pro-NATO people saying, well, first of all, they're like, this can't be a lie because it's in the Times and Maxim Tucker's, you know, he's got the right ideas as a reporter. It seems to be there, but it just can't be real because the report quotes Americans saying, yes, we did the targeting. and the Ukrainians saying, we fired HIMARS rockets right around the nuclear power plant, around the reactor.
What'd they do, miss?
What it is they got very close. They hit, presumably the target, so they didn't actually, no missile, thank God, went astray and hit a fucking reactor. But they got wiped out. Basically, the Russians were ready for it, which is really interesting.
Well, you know what I think it is? I think it's the big boreal mammal lobby because, Chernobyl turned out really well for the wolves.
Yeah.
I think the wolves were running this.
Yes. No, that's what I totally agree with you. I think the thought was, look, what's the worst that can happen? A Chernobyl meltdown. That'll work great for us. Yeah. Then we have to intervene and whatever the hell. Like, I don't think they really gave a shit. And I don't think
I don't think anybody believes there's a lot of concern for Ukrainian lives or Russian lives among the NATO elites. Or if anybody does, I'd be amazed.
But and what they would do is just say the Russian, because if you remember right around that time, there were all these reports that the Russians were shelling themselves. And the Russians kept saying, we're obviously not shelling ourselves. I mean, you can accuse us of a lot of things, but not shelling ourselves in a nuclear power plant. And then the Europeans would come in and say, well, the both sides, there's evidence of both. They might be shelling themselves. They might not be shelling themselves. It was kind of crazy. And this story comes out. It really bothered people who cared looking at it, but most people just decided, I don't want to think about it. And so it lapsed kind of like, it didn't lapse in the same way Hirsch's has, because they're still trying to come up with a counter narrative to Hirsch and it's not working out. I just find that pretty.
That is
pretty
amazing.
Crazy.
The HIMARS, that's a big, expensive, fancy missile.
Yeah.
I mean, firing that, wow.
Yeah, it's called Ukraine's secret attempt to retake the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant with meltdown and ever-present threat. Yeah, when you're firing missiles at it, the stakes behind the attack could not have been
big
higher.
Big missiles. Big
but,
missiles.
You know, if they hit it, they would say the Russians did it. And isn't that more proof of the perfidy of Russia? And everyone would believe him. I mean, who's not going to believe it? So anyway, I just had to get that one out there on that wretched note. I think we could end the episode. Thanks again, everyone. Talk to you soon, John. Get some rest.
All right. To you soon. Bye-bye.